assets which were illegally blocked in South Korea due to US sanctions has started. Palestinians hold a funeral procession for a young man killed by Israeli forces in the occupied West Bank. And the West African ECOWAS bloc approves military intervention in Niger as soon as possible to remove the country's military rulers. Thank you for joining us. In today's top story, Iran's foreign ministry has announced the start of a process to unblock the country's assets that were frozen in South Korea due to US sanctions.
The process for releasing several billion dollars of the Islamic Republic of Iran's assets, which had been illegally frozen in South Korea by the United States for several years, has started. Iran has received necessary guarantees that the U.S. will abide by its commitments in this regard.
The ministry's statement said Iran will use the released assets and funds to meet the country's needs as it deems necessary. It added that a number of Iranians who have been illegally detained in the U.S. on baseless accusations will also be released. The ministry said several American prisoners in Iran whose freedom was sought by Washington are still in Tehran. Earlier, Iran's mission at the United Nations had confirmed that five American inmates in Tehran's Evin prison have been released to house arrest in preparation for a prisoner swap between the two countries. The 15th Iran-South Africa Joint Economic Commission has wrapped up with 26 cooperation agreements being worked out. In the meeting, the two delegations also shared views on important bilateral and international issues. Gisumi Shahamadi has the details.
It's fully ready.
The 15th Iran-South Africa Joint Commission in Pretoria has wrapped up with 26 cooperation agreements drafted and waiting to be finalized when Iran's president travels to South Africa later in autumn. Another sign of growing ties between the two countries that already enjoy close relations and have always supported each other during hard times.
One of the duties of Iran-South Africa Joint Commission is to come up with solutions to help establish peace and prosperity for nations in Africa and Asia. Moreover, we have high hopes for the outcome and achievements of this commission meeting in enhancing bilateral relations.
The Joint Economic Commission has proven to be more than just that, with shared views on international developments, which confirm Iran's foreign minister's comments when he said great steps have been taken to consolidate relations in various areas. But considering the geopolitical position of the Islamic Republic of Iran and the Republic of South Africa, with Iran eyeing a BRICS membership, it seems that the commonalities might lead to stronger relations than what it's been defined by the Joint Commission. Ties that may transcend the realms of bilateral cooperation in a world where more and more countries have expressed their frustration with Western hegemony and U.S. unilateralism.
Dear Minister, you know we are important members of what is termed the Global South. Both our countries are members of the Non-Aligned Movement. Our two nations support multilateralism and thus appreciate the role of the United Nations as the premier multilateral institution, while also advocating strongly for the reform of the United Nations, particularly the role and composition of the United Nations as Security Council.
With the Iranian president expected to pay two separate visits to South Africa, one to attend the BRICS Plus summit on August 24th and another to finalize the 26 cooperation agreements that were drafted by the 15 Joint Commission, prospects of a significant alliance are now stronger than ever. South Africa is considered an important country of the African continent, and the Islamic Republic of Iran has enjoyed warm relations with this country for decades. Now the Raisi administration wants these relations to go to the next level, achieving their full potential, all in line with a new multipolar world order that is emerging. Kisumisha Ahmadi, Pretoria.
Earlier, we discussed the significance of Iran's foreign minister's trip to South Africa in our news review program.
It's time now for the news review of this bulletin. Wagisul Misha Ahmadi is in Pretoria, who joins us now to tell us more about this very important trip. We have Mohammed Khalid Said, who's a member of the Western Cape Provincial Parliament in Cape Town, who also joins us. Welcome to you both. Gisu, so tell us, this is pretty interesting. It's a day-long trip, but it's got to be important. What exactly has transpired, and what was the reason for the Iranian foreign minister to go there, and hopefully some good news to come out of it?
Well, actually, you're absolutely right, Kaveh. This is a very important trip. Let's not forget that the 15th Joint Economic Commission was held after a three-year hiatus due to the coronavirus pandemic. And the fact that the Iranian foreign minister traveled here, let's not forget that he was here less than a month ago for the BRICS Plus Foreign Ministers Summit in Cape Town. And he's back less than a month for this Joint Economic Commission. The huge number of bilateral cooperation agreements that were drafted today, and of course, they will be finalized for the president, who will be traveling to South Africa, particularly for the expansion of bilateral ties later in autumn. That is a separate trip, Kaveh, I would like to note, from the trip that the Iranian president will be taking to South Africa on the 24th of August to take part in the BRICS Plus Head of State Summit. All of this signifies that the ties between Iran and South Africa are growing significantly. Now, let's not forget that Iran has always been a supporter of the South African liberation movement, and it has been enhancing its ties that were already warm since 1994. But now, with the Raisi administration, Iran is adamant to take these relations to the next level, making it more significant, stronger, based on the potentials that exist for the two countries. In the meantime, Iran has also applied to become a full member of BRICS, and that is another issue on the agenda. And as we heard the South African foreign minister mention and point to Iran as a country which is considered among the global South, it was quite interesting to see that the foreign minister of South Africa did actually treat Iran as an equal member. So even if we still don't have the news that Iran has become a full member of BRICS, because we do know that they're still working out the kinks, they already have about 19 countries that have applied to become members of BRICS, and they're still trying to figure out how to devise the mechanics for new member states to be added to this organization. But the way that she talked to the Iranian foreign minister, the way she referred to him, and the issues that were brought up during the press conference, the mutual grounds, and also the views that the two countries share regarding international developments on a political and economic scale, the new world order, which is a multipolar world order, which is agreed by both countries, and they both emphasized that during the press conference. All of these, Kaveh, signify that we will be hearing some good news.
Hopefully we will. I still have a lot to ask you. Hopefully we can fit it in this news review. All right, so Mohammed, I don't know about you, but it's very hard to keep up with all the developments that come when it comes to BRICS in general, and of course with the summit, upcoming summit. I mean, from India convincing 22 countries to trade in their national currencies, with the SWIFT payment system to be replaced, with the African countries and many other, aside from African countries, to apply for membership. We're looking at a whole roster of developments, but many of them have one theme in common, and that is the push away from the dollar, not to separate themselves from the Western financial world, but to basically, I guess, again, to de-dollarize the economies. Tell us why that is important when it comes to BRICS in general and the respective countries.
Thank you so much. It is extremely important because the de-dollarization and us standing together as BRICS countries and BRICS friends such as Iran, who would hopefully be also joining BRICS, it's not only an issue of money at the surface level. It speaks to an issue of ensuring political autonomy as well, because we know if they utilize the dollar to abuse us and to have hegemony over us, particularly at the economic level, they're then able to influence our foreign policy and our domestic policy. So it goes way beyond even just ensuring that we have sustainable economies and that we are self-sufficient and that we can assist each other. It's interlinked, and that in itself is interlinked to us having political autonomy, domestic autonomy, and our own national identity and dignity intact.
All right, thank you very much for that, Mohammed Khalid Sayed, member of the Western Cape Provincial Parliament. And Gisu, thank you so much. Gisu Mishama, your correspondent there from Pretoria. And with that, we come to an end for this news review. Thanks for tuning in.
Palestinians lay to rest the body of a youth killed by Israeli forces in the occupied West Bank. Hundreds of Palestinians took part in a funeral procession of Amir Abu Khalifa. He was shot dead during a raid on Zawata, a town in the Nablus governorate. Palestinian resistance groups have offered their condolences to the family of Khalifa, saying that the fight against the Israeli regime will continue till victory. Israel has been carrying out deadly raids across the occupied territories almost on a daily basis. More than 200 Palestinians have been killed in Israeli onslaughts since the start of the year. A human rights advocacy group says the increasing violence by Israeli settlers has caused many Palestinian communities to be wiped off the map in the occupied territories. The Norwegian Refugee Council said in a report that around 500 Palestinians from seven communities have been forcibly displaced over the past 20 months. It added that the rapid establishment of settlement outposts and takeover of Palestinian land is choking Palestinian communities, destroying their livelihoods and putting their lives at risk. The report revealed that Israeli settlers have attacked Palestinians nearly 600 times in the occupied West Bank in the first half of this year, causing casualties and property damage. It warned that more and more Palestinian communities will be forcibly displaced if Israel is not held accountable. The Economic Community of West African States, ECOWAS, has green-lighted military intervention in Niger to remove its military rulers following last month's coup. Ivory Coast President Alassane Ouattara says heads of state of the 15-nation bloc have agreed that the operation should start as soon as possible. Ouattara said his country will provide a maximum of 1,100 troops alongside soldiers from Nigeria and Benin. Other member countries will join them later. Earlier on Thursday, the ECOWAS leaders said they would deploy a standby force to restore Niger's President Mohamed Bazoum, who was toppled on July the 26th. A deadline set by the bloc for Bazoum to be reinstated on August the 6th was ignored by the Nigerian junta. The junta has announced a new government with 21 ministers. ECOWAS has a history of military interventions in West African countries, including Liberia, Sierra Leone, and Gambia. Junior doctors in England have launched a new walkout over a pay dispute with the government, putting more strain on the National Health Service. The four-day industrial action, which starts on Friday and continues until Tuesday, is expected to significantly disrupt medical services. It comes amid record patient waiting times due to a large pandemic backlog and general strikes across all economic sectors. The British Medical Association says their junior doctors' pay has fallen by 26% in the last 15 years. The government says a 6% pay rise and an extra lump sum payment announced in mid-June is final. Thousands of medical appointments have been postponed across England's health service due to strike actions since last December. Britain has been rocked by public and private sector walkouts for months amid an unprecedented cost of living crisis and record high inflation. Sana'a's international airport remains closed despite the signing of a ceasefire agreement deal with the Saudi-led coalition last year, which was supposed to lift the restrictions. The government is accusing the coalition of exacerbating the crisis there. Yusuf Mowry reports.
The Sana'a government is accusing the Saudi-led coalition of exacerbating the humanitarian crisis in Yemen through what it called the illegal blockade on Sana'a International Airport. Before the war was launched against Yemen, over 6,500 passengers were able to fly in and out of Sana'a International Airport per day. However, that number has drastically been reduced to only 900 passengers per week due to the blockade imposed on the country. Because of these restrictions, many sick Yemenis have died since they were not able to fly out of the country in time to seek proper medical treatment. And that's mainly because the Saudi coalition only allows 3 flights into Sana'a Airport per week, a move which violates last year's ceasefire agreement, which stipulated airport restrictions would be lifted. According to the director of Sana'a Airport, Khaled Ashaif, these days Sana'a Airport is mainly used by UN flights for diplomatic purposes only.
After the ceasefire agreement was signed, Sana'a International Airport was supposed to resume flights from Jordan and Egypt. Unfortunately, the Saudi coalition did not meet its end of the deal. They only allowed flights from Jordan, and these flights were limited to 3 per week instead of the agreed 6 flights. I would like the world to know that Sana'a International Airport remains closed. As you can see, the only flights available are those belonging to the United Nations.
Because of limited flights into Sana'a, over 2,500 Yemenis remain stranded in Amman, Jordan.
We are living here in the streets of Amman, as you can see. There are many here who are also stranded and paying ridiculous prices for plane tickets. The prices for Yemen tickets are the most expensive in the world.
Ahmed Ashaf, a Yemeni-British citizen, received news that his mother was ill in Yemen. He was forced to book a flight and try to fly back home as soon as possible. But instead, he was stranded in Amman, Jordan, for 3 weeks.
After I got news that my mother was sick and was taken to intensive care, I needed to fly back to Sana'a immediately. Instead, I was stranded for 3 weeks, unable to visit her. This is a sad and tragic reality. When I finally arrived at Sana'a Airport, I spoke with many of other Yemenis who also suffered in Amman Airport and other airports around the world because they cannot fly back home due to their restrictions.
The Sana'a government continues to urge the Saudi-led coalition to abide by the ceasefire agreement and open Sana'a Airport. Otherwise, all options are on the table. Yusuf Mowry, Sana'a.
Well, those were the top stories for this hour. Thank you for listening.
Bustle of life. The sound of living. Only sound will endure.
Hello.
IRIB English Radio.
In the limelight.
A joint naval exercise meant to show Beijing and Moscow's close strategic relationship has just ended near Alaska. We take a look at the world media's coverage of this story. Please stay with us. South China Morning Post has covered this story and tells us more. The U.S. military's heightened response to a Russian-Chinese flotilla near Alaska was meant to send a message of force, according to a Chinese military analyst. What we see now is a flexing of muscles as the Ukraine war continues, former People's Liberation Army instructor Song Zhongping emphasized. Song Zhongping added, "The U.S. wants to underscore that it is the real leading power in the North Atlantic by stepping up its response to the joint patrol by the Chinese and Russian navies." According to U.S. Senators Lisa Murkowski and Dan Sullivan, four U.S. Navy destroyers, along with a P-8 Poseidon maritime patrol aircraft, were sent last week to monitor the Russian and Chinese flotilla of 11 vessels. It came nearly a year after a U.S. Coast Guard ship encountered a seven-vessel Chinese-Russian fleet sailing about 75 nautical miles north of Kiska Island in the Alaskan waters. Last summer, the Chinese and Russian navies conducted a similar operation off the coast of Alaska, Senator Dan Sullivan emphasized. He continued, "Given that our response was tepid, I strongly encourage senior military leaders to be ready with a much more robust response should such another joint Chinese-Russian naval operation occur off our coast." I was heartened to see that this latest incursion was met with four U.S. Navy destroyers, which sends a strong message to President Xi Jinping and President Putin that the United States will not hesitate to protect and defend our vital national interests in Alaska, the senator said, referring to the Chinese and Russian leaders. Meanwhile, Russia's defense ministry said the joint exercise involved communications training, helicopter landings and takeoffs from the decks of each other's ships. There was also a joint anti-submarine exercise in the southwestern part of the Bering Sea. Former People's Liberation Army instructor Song Zhongping said the joint naval exercise, which also involved a passage through the Sea of Japan, was meant to highlight the close relationship between the two countries amid the war in Ukraine. With their no-limit ties, Beijing and Moscow want to show their determination to strengthen their strategic cooperation, Song Zhongping said. Just like the U.S. freedom of navigation in the backyard of China in the Asia-Pacific, the People's Liberation Army and Russian military want to show they can sail and operate anywhere as international law allows. The Beijing-based naval expert Li Ji said the stepped-up response by the U.S. showed that Washington was concerned about the collaboration between China and Russia in the Arctic. Alaskan waters are part of the Arctic shipping routes. The joint naval drills have again reminded the United States of China's role in Russia's Arctic strategy, the naval expert Li Ji said. He added, "Russia would likely see greater financial support from Beijing to finance its ambitious North Pole exploration. However, Drew Thompson, a visiting senior research fellow at the National University of Singapore's Lee Kuan Yew School of Public Policy, said the Alaska drill might backfire on Beijing, particularly in relation to its criticism of U.S. freedom of navigation missions in the South China Sea and the Taiwan Strait. It strikes me how difficult it is for China to continue claiming that U.S. military operations in the Western Pacific are an obstacle to improving relations when it conducts military operations off the U.S. coast on a recurring basis," Drew Thompson said. He added, "It is time for China to accept U.S. military missions on its periphery and engage in military-to-military dialogue if it wants to be treated as a major world power." The Islamic Republic of Iran's Mehr news agency has also covered the same story and tells us more. A large group of Russian and Chinese warships passed near the coast of Alaska last week, with a group of U.S. destroyers scrambling to shadow the naval patrol, according to U.S. defense officials and lawmakers, Russia Today reported. In a statement on Saturday, two Republican senators representing the state of Alaska, Lisa Murkowski and Dan Sullivan, said a total of 11 ships had been detected transiting U.S. waters in the Aleutians, citing a classified briefing and labeling the activities an incursion. Republican Senator Dan Sullivan said he was pleased to see a robust U.S. response involving four American destroyers to the joint military exercises by China and Russia. Meanwhile, the U.S. Northern Command has confirmed that Russian and Chinese ships were indeed conducting a patrol in the area, but did not provide details on the number of ships involved. The agency's spokesperson also noted, according to the Wall Street Journal, that air and maritime assets under our commands conducted operations to assure the defense of the U.S. and Canada. However, the official did not confirm the senator's remarks about an incursion, stressing that the Chinese-Russian force remained in international waters and was not considered a threat. Brent Sadler, a senior research fellow at the Heritage Foundation, has called the patrol a historical first and highly provocative, considering tensions over Taiwan and the Ukraine conflict, the Wall Street Journal reported. On Friday, the Russian Defense Ministry stated that Moscow's navy was continuing its patrols in the Pacific together with Chinese warships sailing through the Sea of Japan, La Perouse Strait, the Sea of Okhotsk, and the Kamchatka Strait. It added that the drill involved a joint anti-submarine exercise as well as helicopter landings and takeoffs from the decks of each other's ships. Commenting on the military exercises, Liu Pengyu, a spokesman for the Chinese embassy in Washington, insisted that this action is not targeted at any third party and has nothing to do with the current international and regional situation, apparently referring to the Ukraine conflict and a standoff between Washington and Beijing over Taiwan. U.S. national broadcaster ABC News has also covered the same story. The nearly dozen Russian and Chinese ships that sailed near Alaska's Aleutian Islands last week as part of a joint naval exercise, leading the U.S. to deploy warships and aircraft to monitor the formation, are now moving away from the region, according to two American officials. In response to the ship's movements near the island chain, four U.S. Navy destroyers operating in the Pacific Ocean had monitored the ship's movements from various distances, one of the U.S. officials confirmed. Both officials stressed that the 11 Russian and Chinese warships remained in international waters and did not sail into U.S. territorial waters, which stretch out 12 miles from the Alaskan coastline. U.S. officials declined to provide details on how close the Russian and Chinese ships got to American territory. The patrol marked an apparent show of military unity and strength between the two countries. One of the officials told ABC News that Russian and Chinese vessels operated in different locations and were not always in the same formation. Video posted by Russia's Defense Ministry on Saturday showed what appeared to be at least 9 vessels sailing in formation and the firing of weapons into the ocean, presumably as part of what it described as an anti-submarine exercise. The Russian Defense Ministry said the joint patrol had already covered 2,300 nautical miles in a transit that had taken the Russian and Chinese Navy ships to the southwestern part of the Bering Sea, where they had practiced joint tactical maneuvering, conducted communications training, and carried out helicopter landings and takeoffs from the decks of each other's ships. A U.S. official told ABC News that the Pentagon was tracking and expecting this patrol for several weeks, since well before the exercises began. In addition to the four U.S. destroyers, a U.S. Navy P-8 maritime surveillance aircraft was also used to monitor the joint Russian and Chinese naval patrols, according to officials.
I'm a teacher.
I'm a researcher.
I'm a mother.
I'm a lawyer.
And I believe in acting kindly toward you, because you are...
A Muslim lady. You are very special. There's no one just like you. You are very special. And I'm so glad you're mine.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Assalamu alaikum, dear listeners of Arab English Radio. Muslim ladies from all around the world, welcome back to a new episode of your very favorite program. Well, this is Asma at your service as the host. And just like always, we have Sister Zainab in here. Assalamu alaikum, sister.
Walaikum assalam. Thank you so much.
So it's such a pleasure to be here with you again. So recently, I've been reading this quote from Imam Ali alayhi salam that I'm just going to give you the gist of what he said. Well, he says that there are some characteristics that are good to be seen in a man, but at the same time, they are not good to be seen in a woman. So that means there are some special characteristics that are good to be attributed to a man, but not to a woman. Like for example, being stingy. Well, everybody knows that it's not a good thing. But if you attribute that to a woman, it would be good. And then you're going to explain why.
Yeah, I would explain that the hadith says that the best attributes of women are the worst attributes of men. And he explains three of them. That's the kind of self-conceit, cowardice.
Being arrogant or pompous, you mean?
Yeah. Or, again, being stingy or miser, and the third is fear or, you know, cowardice.
Not being too courageous.
Right.
Honestly speaking, at the first glance, when you look at it, you feel like, oh, what? What?
Yeah. Hey, you have that kind of, you know, reaction towards this. If you don't go into the contemplation of the same
thing. You have to read between the lines.
Exactly. Talked about being miser. So if she is miser or stingy, it safeguards the wealth of her husband.
Yeah.
Well, in this hadith, the meaning of miserliness is that a woman is a trustee for her husband's property.
Yeah.
So she's supposed to protect it. And however, this attribute is good for all those who are trustee of somebody's, you know, amana. Mm-hmm. Or somebody's trust. So it can help you basically, especially a woman, to save money, who like even to save money. This quality, this trait that Imam Ali alayhi salam is explaining, it could help them save money and resources by making, you know, by being more frugal or careful.
Yeah.
And she's more cautious, basically, and she becomes rational and analytical. Mm-hmm. If she possesses this quality. Getting a little more deeper into this, this trait basically helps her to avoid waste.
Yeah, I understand.
And excess, which is promoted, unfortunately, on the media, like, you know, buy this, buy that.
But generosity is a very, very beautiful characteristic.
It is, but this stinginess does not contrast with the generous, being generous. Mm-hmm. Because Imam Ali alayhi salam did not mention this, basically, that she should be miser with her own property. Just since, because I mentioned that she is a trustee of her husband's property. So she is basically, you know, a kind of cautious and miser, and this kind of trait she has towards the property of her husband or the property she accepts as a trustee.
Mm-hmm.
So for her own property, she could be generous, definitely.
And I would add another perspective to that. Why we shouldn't be so generous If I want to analyze that code, I would say, according to my very limited knowledge, I would say that what Imam Ali means is exactly something like this, that it's okay for you to be generous, but not showing off with your generosity. Because again, as a woman,
you're emotional.
Yeah, since you're emotional, you're going to be thought of as an easy target. So maybe other people with bad intentions would come and abuse you. But whether it be your wealth, your, I don't know, emotions or anything.
Right.
Because, you know, we are so delicate and sensitive, and just add to that generosity. So it's going to be sort of bad for yourself.
Right. So, yeah, apart from these things, it also provides a kind of financial security to her. You know, like when she has this trade, she's more careful with money. And thus able to accumulate savings, as we said, and then provide a safety net in case of unexpected emergencies, which is very, very important, or financial hardships that come.
Yeah.
And you would have often seen in families, whenever there's this financial hardship or emergencies coming out, it's always a woman who would come for the help. It's just most of the times who would...
Most of the time. But yes, because they are the ones with savings.
Right, see? Why did they do savings here? Because of this trait.
Exactly, yeah. So there's actually a lot more to this code, but let's go for a short break, and then in a heartbeat we'll be back. Yes, Imam Ali alayhi salam says there are some special characteristics that are good to be seen in a man, and a man must have them, but a woman must not. The three of them are mentioned. One of them is being stingy. It's good for a woman to be stingy, to be fearful, and be arrogant and pompous. So, yes, this is Muslim Lady. We're talking about you from all around the world. And, yes, thank you for being with us, Sister Zainab. So, how come it's a good thing to be stingy?
Yeah, we were saying why.
Yeah.
So, you know, women having a stingy kind of behavior.
So, just to give the gist of the first part, just to say of the headlines, I would say the titles of why it's good to be stingy for a woman is, first thing first, it's good for yourself because you are not going to be considered as an easy target and nobody is going to harm you. This is the first thing. And then second of all, what Sister mentioned was the fact that if you are going to practice stinginess, then you are going to protect your husband's property.
And also be at his side for financial hardships. In case of emergencies.
Yeah, you would come as that protecting angel with savings.
Right. And you yourself have less stress. When you have this trait, you have less stress. Because women who live with their means and avoid unnecessary expenditures may experience less financial stress. And financial stress is the worst forms of stress.
Exactly, yeah. Especially these days.
Yeah. So she has less stress, less anxiety, and they have fewer financial obligations to worry about.
Yeah. So women are better to be economical.
Right. And this also helps them to be a best decision maker at the same time. Now how? Being mindful of one's spending habits, because when Imam Ali says that you should be miser, this is good for her. So she's mindful of what she's, you know, spending. So when she's mindful of that, those habits of her spending, this may lead her to a better decision making in other areas of life as well. Like she could learn to weigh the costs and benefits of various options because she plays a major role in other spheres of life as well. So she is balanced even there. And she has an increased self-discipline practicing this frugality. It requires a certain level of self-discipline and restraint. and which could be mm-hmm. beneficial again in yeah. other areas of life.
Exactly. But still, I don't like the word stingy.
It's not good all the time.
Yeah.
But for a minute, it's good in these spheres where I'm saying exactly. if being stingy or frugal mm-hmm. is not helping you with these things, it's making yeah. you greedy or taking you down the line, then mm-hmm. You should be practicing generosity.
Again, I would say that being economical, not maybe, of course, being economical is a good thing. Not being too overly generous, maybe for a woman, is a good thing. But I guess the thing that Imam Ali means to say is for the benefit of women in the case of protecting themselves from others. You know, right. I guess it's a good thing to be generous for your family.
Right.
Generous for your brothers, sisters, mother, father, and your immediate family. And again, generous for the people who are in need. Generous for,
imagine a situation mm-hmm. wherein you have developed habits of spending a lot of money.
Yeah.
Okay. Now in your society, there are cancer patients.
Yeah.
Now you at the same time love to be generous. But when you have these high habits, you don't practice miserliness, how could you help that?
Yeah.
Maybe your this habit would lead
you... I understand.
Help a kind of patient yeah. who is in need. It's not always in the need of mm-hmm. emergency of your own family. You could be a hero for anyone in the society.
And a larger scale.
Yeah. Practicing this miserliness... but for the emergency situations, but not for, it's very, very bad. The same trait becomes worse when you practice that in terms of like when your husband wants to support his own family, his mother, he wants to take care of his brother or his, you know, who are down the line in terms of finance or who don't have enough financial security and you become a barrier. It's really bad trait over there.
Yeah.
But you have to be miser in terms of like not letting him spend.
You should just, I guess, again, practice moderation.
It's basically...
Do not go for extreme levels.
It's basically being cautious and spending.
Yeah, yeah, exactly.
What Imam Ali Lisa wants to say is like women, it's better for them to be cautious in spending. But
and
not
careful.
For, why not for men? Because men has to provide the financial security to women. He has to provide food, shelter, clothes, the basic needs to a woman. Mm-hmm. And if he becomes miser, hair or frugal in his attitude, he would be able to run his house
and then,
properly.
I guess
and there would be fights then.
Yeah, and he would never extend his environment if he's a frugal person.
Right.
He so would that's never why, get to know other people, get to know the world.
Yeah, that's why, and he would have limited expectations even from his, you know.
Exactly.
Hardships that he's doing,
yeah.
the work he's doing, because he would say, I don't spend much, mm-hmm. so I don't need much.
Just to give you some more of time to think about what's going on in here, about these three attributes and characteristics, let's go for a short break and come back for the last part of today's episode.
This is IRIB English Radio. You're listening to Muslim Lady.
So, Sister Zainab, you have only 1 minute to add anything in case you have something missing.
So we're talking about why is it a good trait for women? And since we are dealing with Muslim women, so we talked more about women. But I would also summarize in the end that it's the opposite trait of the same being stingy, the opposite trait being generous for men. It is good. Imam Ali alayhi salam considers it a good quality or a good trait because specifically for men, being generous can have many additional benefits than what we said. So far, research has shown that generosity is strongly associated with positive masculinity traits, such as compassion, empathy, and also altruism. Men who are generous may be seen as more caring, trustworthy, and socially responsible, which can enhance their reputation and social standing, and also in their family, basically. Because... man gains that trustworthiness mm-hmm. because of this trait.
Generosity is the greatest characteristic that you could see in anyone. But then when Imam Ali says it, and since whatever he says is the wisest of all the wisdom that could be shared with other people, so there are too many perspectives to look at this quote from, and I suppose the entire idea behind it is to protect a woman from any kind of abuse that would come to her.
Right.
So, yeah, thank you, sister, and thank you, dear listeners. You have more time to think about it and to go and search about what this quote would mean. And thank you for being with us until another session. I bid you farewell. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
I know I'm waiting for something, something to happen to me. This waiting comes with trials and challenges. Nothing in life is free.
Follow us on social media to stay up to date on the latest global developments. You can keep in touch with us by following us on Twitter at twitter.com/ParsTodayEN. You can also follow IRIB English Radio on Instagram via instagram.com/ParsTodayEnglish.
In the limelight.
In Britain, the government is drawing up plans to drop Britain's flagship £11.6 billion climate and nature funding pledge. We take a look at the world media's coverage of this story. Please stay with us. The British newspaper The Guardian has covered this story and tells us more. The government is drawing up plans to drop Britain's flagship £11.6 billion climate and nature funding pledge, The Guardian can reveal, with Prime Minister Rishi Sunak accused of betraying populations most vulnerable to global heating. The disclosure provoked fury from former ministers and representatives of vulnerable countries, who accused Prime Minister Sunak of making false promises. A leaked briefing note to ministers, given to the Foreign Office and seen by The Guardian, lays out the reasons for dropping Britain's contribution to meeting the global $100 billion a year commitment to developing countries. The leaked briefing says, "Our commitment to double our international climate finance to £11.6 billion was made back in 2019 when we were still at 0.7% of GDP spent on international aid and pre-COVID pandemic." It adds that to meet it, by the deadline would be a huge challenge because of new pressures, including help for Ukraine being included in the aid budget. To meet the £11.6 billion target by 2026, government officials have calculated that it would have to spend 83% of the Foreign Office's official development assistance budget on the International Climate Fund. Civil servants said in the leaked document that this would squeeze out room for other commitments, such as humanitarian commitments. It also claimed that factors such as the war in Ukraine and debt relief could make it even more difficult to meet the target. This is because the government has cut international aid spending to 0.5% of gross national income since the announcement was made, squeezing budgets across the board, and because ministers did not spend most of the money allocated to the climate fund over the past few years, leaving the majority to be spent by 2026. Britain spent £5.8 billion over the previous 5 years, up to 2021. This was doubled to spend £11.6 billion between April of 2021 and March of 2026, £3 billion of which was earmarked for protecting and restoring nature for meeting commitments made in COP15 summit last December. The projects funded included building renewable energy, helping create low-pollution transport, and protecting forests in sensitive areas around the globe. Former Foreign Office Minister Zach Goldsmith, who resigned last week, citing what he termed Rishi Sunak's apathy towards the environment, said this would shred the UK's international reputation. Former Foreign Office Minister Zach Goldsmith told The Guardian, "The low levels of expenditure so far, combined with the decision to define our spending on Afghan and Ukrainian refugees here in the United Kingdom as aid, something that other countries have not done, means it is going to be virtually impossible to honour our environmental promise. The hockey stick of spending will be so steep that whoever is in government after the next election would have to savagely slash humanitarian, education, health and other funding in order to hit the £11.6 billion target. So even while it is technically possible to claim we will honour that pledge, the next government will simply not be able to do so. Small island states in particular, whose votes in the United Nations are no less valuable than ours and which are routinely needed by us, will be left feeling utterly betrayed. Given around 25 Commonwealth countries are small island states, as well as our interests in the Pacific Ocean and the Caribbean, the geopolitical repercussions will be far-reaching and our reputation as a reliable partner will simply be shredded." Last week, the British government's statutory climate advisers published a report finding that the government was missing the majority of its climate targets and had lost its position as a world leader on climate change. Countries due to receive the funding have expressed dismay at the prospect of a funding cut. Lee White, Gabon's environmental minister, said, "The climate crisis is such that every country has to contribute to the solution. Gabon is 88% covered by tropical rainforest. We have maintained deforestation below 0.1% over 5 decades and net absorb over 100 million tons of carbon dioxide annually. Few countries are doing more for the planet. Developed nations, particularly the United Kingdom, which was the origin of the Industrial Revolution, have to do the heavy lifting. But all too often, they make false promises and fail to provide true leadership or even honour their modest financial commitments." The British newspaper The Daily Mail has also covered the same story and tells us more. The British government is drawing up plans to drop Britain's flagship £11.6 billion climate and nature funding pledge. Prime Minister Rishi Sunak has been accused of betraying populations in countries which are most vulnerable to global warming. The decision is likely to diminish Britain's standing on the world stage as international groups accuse it of squandering its reputation. Claire Shakir, the strategic director of the International Institute for Environmental and Development, said, "A decision by this government to drop the pledge of £11.6 billion in climate finance is somewhat unsurprising, given cuts they have already made to programmes that would have used the funding. But it's no less disappointing. Not only could that funding have helped some of the most vulnerable people already facing drought, flooding and wildfires brought on by climate change, its provision was also a demonstration of Britain's leadership in the face of climate crisis. The British government seems content to squander what standing it had on the world stage to bring countries together to face this global emergency." The briefing note suggests a departure from Britain's previous plans to be at the forefront of addressing the challenges associated with climate change and biodiversity loss. When the funding was announced, the government departments involved called climate finance the top priority for government over the next decade and described the fund as a vital tool in the government's commitment to tackle climate change internationally. Meanwhile, the Foreign Office has declined to comment on the leak, but has pointed to Prime Minister Rishi Sunak's comments made at COP27 summit regarding climate finance. A spokesperson for the Foreign Office said, "We spent over £1.4 billion on international climate finance over the course of 2021-2022 financial year, supporting developing countries to reduce poverty and respond to causes and impacts of climate change. We'll publish the latest annual figures in due course." Claims that the international climate finance pledge is being dropped are false. As the Prime Minister set out at the COP27 summit, the British government remains committed to spending £11.6 billion on international climate finance, and we continue to deliver on that pledge.
Iranian news, Iranian culture, Iranian voice. This is IRIB English Radio. This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.
Thank you.
Your headlines for this hour: Iran says the process for